Mr. Coombs. Are we ready to go?
Tell you about those. I think we are.
Real briefly, I'm going to put us on the record via preamble, and it's pretty self-explanatory. Okay. This is Victor Cunicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is August 31st, 2010. The time is approximately 10:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm accompanied by various members of the FCIC, Richard Siren, and counsel. We're at the offices of the FCIC for the interview of Mr. Siren. The interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. Siren. Mr. Siren, could I get your verbal assent on the record?
Yes.
Okay. Will everyone please state your full name and affiliation for the record? Please spell your last name for the transcriptionist. I'll start. We can go around right, maybe. Cunicelli is spelled C-U-N-I-C-E-L-L-I.
I'm Alexander Mosry on the research team at the FCIC, and the last name is M-A-A-S-R-Y.
I'm Katie Durick with Sidley Austin. Last name is spelled Durick, D-U-R-I-C-K.
Mark Hopson from Sidley Austin, representing Dick Siren. It's Hopson, H-O-P as in Paul, S-O-N.
Dick Siren, representing myself. Last name is S-Y-R-O-N.
Tom Green, spelled G-R-E-E-N, from Sidley Austin.
Sabrina Ross from Sidley Austin, spelled R-O-S-S.
I'm Alexis Simondare with the FCIC, and it's S-I-M-E-N-D-I-N-G-E-R.
I'm Stephen Mintz with the FCIC, and it's M-I-N-T-Z.
Tom Stanton with the FCIC, S-T-A-N-T-O-N.
And I'm Bob Hinckley, H-I-N-K-L-E-Y, also with the FCIC.
Okay, Mr. Siren, in the way of background, the FCIC was established by statute, public law 111-21, and signed by into law by the president. It is bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It's charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the president and Congress by December 15, 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I can provide you a copy of the statute by which the commission was formed, if you so desire. Please be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States, and FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code, Section 1001, concerning false statements. So every statement you need to say today needs to be truthful. That's it as far as the preamble. Thank you.
Thanks, Vic. The first thing we usually do, Mr. Siren, when we kick these things off, is we ask the witness to tell us about their career since college.
I got out of college. I went to work for the. I got out of college and went to graduate school at Tufts University to get a PhD in economics, and I worked kind of casual labor, manual jobs for that, except one summer I started working for the Federal Reserve Bank in Boston. And then I went to work for them full-time after I graduated, after I got my PhD.
If you could give dates.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you very much.
Let's see. I started working full-time for the Federal Reserve, I think it was 1969, and I got my PhD. I think it was in 1972. I get mixed up with 72 or 71. Then I worked for the Federal Reserve for some substantial period of time. I went. This is going to take a while.
You had a long and distinguished career. Take as much time as you want.
Well, long.
That's right. I went on loan from the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston on leave to the state of Massachusetts for a while. I worked for the. Do you want me to treat the Federal Reserve as one, or do you want all the different things in the Federal Reserve?
It'd be useful if it's the board versus the.
Okay. Then I came back and I went to work at the Board of Governors as an aide to John Sheehan, who was that was an assignment for I think 3 or 4 months, and then I came back and I worked at the Boston Fed for a substantial period of time. Now I got to recall this in 19 1984. I think it was 19. The resume has it. 1984.
Okay.
1984. I left to go to work. I think that's the year for the Federal Home Loan Bank in Boston as the CEO there, and I returned to the. Wait a minute. It's a year up here. You got to work this backwards. In 1989, I became president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. In 19, so it must have been the years 19.
We can get.
Why don't we dispense with the dates of 1989, and we can right. Just give us the
okay, okay.
89, and that works.
And then I left the Federal Home Loan Bank of Boston and became. President of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. Oh, I know why I had screwed up. I left out. I worked for a couple of years in 1980, the end of 1980, 81, and a little bit 82 for Paul Volcker as his personal assistant. Then, at any rate, in 1989, I became president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. I stayed there till 1994, I became chairman, CEO of the American Stock Exchange. I can't believe it. Oh, yeah. 19, what was the year I had for the American Stock Exchange?
1994, you think.
1994, right. I think it was in
1994.
I think it was in 1999 I left there to go become, might have been 2000, to become chief executive officer of a company called Thermo Electron, which is a high-tech electronics company and instrumentation company. And in December of 2003, I left there and became chairman and CEO of Freddie Mac.
So your dates roughly at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, just to try to bracket that one, roughly when were you there? That was during the credit crunch in the early 90s?
Yes, I was the president during the credit crunch.
Okay, thank you.
So from we have a resume someplace. That's
we'll find it.
We'll get it date by date.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, I always...
Just to give us background.
It's a distinguished career. Take a move. A lot to remember. The overall theme here is we're here to investigate the financial crisis, as you know. And in April, we had hearings, and one day Fannie Mae appeared before it and told us about their role in the financial crisis and the housing crisis, the mortgage crisis. And so now we'd like to turn our attention to
sure.
Fannie Mae. Could you give me a brief history of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac under your tenure?
Yeah, I went to Freddie Mac in really beginning of 2004. It was the end of December of 2003. I was hired because, as you know, Freddie Mac had some fairly serious accounting problems. We were not registered with the SEC. That was sort of job one for me among my assignments. We had a substantial number of internal vacancies. We were heavily reliant on consultants. We had something approaching 3,000 consultants working for the company.
Were they working on the remediation or generically across the company?
They were both. But I would say the two main areas were the remediation and information technology. And the other area I was encouraged to spend some real attention to was our mission, because to be sure that we were doing what we were supposed to be doing for our mission.
Who encouraged you to do that?
There was a search committee, and there was I had objectives drawn up, and as I recall, but this is recollection now. As I recall, mission was in there. But at any rate, there was a general agreement among the board that we needed to put, I think, more effort into mission. But that was after fixing the corporation. I don't mean it sequentially, but the fixing the corporation was really the
job one. And you want to take me through from December 2004 to September 2008?
Yeah. Well,
how long did the remediation take?
Well, the remediation took a long time. I mean, we didn't register with the SEC. We registered with the SEC in February of. February of 2008. The basic problem we had is that Freddie had been, a small company, and it had what I might call a small chassis of systems and things like that.
A lot of things writing on it.
Exactly. And it had a lot of things writing on it, and it grew and grew and grew. But, for example, there were a lot of functions that we really didn't have that were sufficient. Our information technology function wasn't sufficient. We really didn't have a real human resources function. There were a lot of things that you would expect a company of the size of Freddie Mac to have. As a matter of fact, if you were to look, say, as an analog to Fannie Mae, we didn't have anywhere near the sophistication and resource depth across areas that they did.
Did you have problems implementing a system of internal controls as required by Sarbanes-Oxley?
Yes, we had internal controls. I think was something that were a concern of us, but I'm thinking before my time, before Sarbanes-Oxley. But we had a lot of controls that were classified in different areas and classified by our regulator as well as by ourselves. pardon me, as needing improvement. This was something that had to be done and was under the auspices of the CFO as well as fixing the accounting. We had to make a number of personnel changes across the organization. In fact, it was kind of sweeping the number of personnel changes we had to do from the general counsel on down. That's what I spent an awful lot of my effort on, that and trying to figure out what is this thing, mm-hmm. and what are its objectives, and how do you weight the different factors that it's supposed to take into consideration.
Let me ask a brief question, if I may. Why, when you came in, why would you find such shortages of critical functions, systems, and people? Setting aside the remediation, which we've all read the OFAO report, it's detailed, but setting that aside, what was going on?
Well, what I think was going on is the company, even though its gross numbers didn't show it, was fairly penurious in support functions. It spent money on other functions like its portfolio management, but in support functions, in functions that weren't directly revenue producing, I thought in many cases we weren't sufficient. Can I take my jacket off?
Absolutely. In fact, if you want, I'll take mine off.
I don't know why he would want you to take your jacket off.
See if he's armed.
Well, some of us are, actually, but nobody at this table. We have people on detail from the Secret Service and various other places. So, you came in December 2004, and it's safe to say the company had just gone through a sorting out some significant accounting problems.
Was in the process of sorting them out, I think. We were in the process of restating financials, I forget, for going back for how many years, but for several years. And we were behind in that process. I mean, we had a lag between our financials and the current period.
And so a significant amount of management's time was taken up with what you call the remediation.
Oh, I would say, in a normal, I mean, there was no question about what job one was in the place. And, you know, we'd have target dates, some of which we made and some of which we didn't make. And it was always, you were always living sort of hand to mouth, worried about where you're going to be in meeting the next target dates, which the board understandably was very interested in, because there were commitments that had been made, I guess, you know, to the regulator, to the Congress, others.
And at about what period of time did this thing sort of start to sort itself out and become a real company?
I would say that in terms of running the business functions, maybe within a year, but a lot longer in terms of getting some of the other functions in place. Like, we got a new auditor, a new general counsel, a new HR guy, a new IT guy. I could go through the list, mm-hmm. but a lot longer. And in fact, I would say it still wasn't completely sorted out when I left.
At some point, did your primary focus shift, though, towards, did the systems get good enough so you could start looking at the business and what had to change to make the business work better?
Yes, well, we started to do that immediately, and the business faced a lot of challenges, because the business model that both the GSEs had operated under, you know, originating back with FDR starting Fannie Mae, and then in my mind, the big mistake of taking it off budget mm-hmm. and privatizing it, which created a lot of conflict in the Johnson administration, I'm sorry, I'm trying to come back to
the question. Was at some point did the systems get good enough so that you started to focus more, less on remediation, more on where the business was going, and what had to be done to make it run better.
Yeah, the systems, I'd say, were functional and could be used, but they just weren't ideal. I mean, you know, there are a lot of things. For example, we had something called end user computers, right? And instead of having a lot of our computer functions centralized, they were done on PCs at end users. Now, that was sort of a hobbled together system, right? Mm-hmm. And it would work, right? But it didn't give you the degree of confidence and security that you wanted to have, but we were able to work with it. You raise a very good question, because if you had an ideal situation, right, you might have said, well, you know, we'll sort of put the car in the garage and fix it and bring it out again. But the problem was that in our primary business, which is guaranteeing long-term fixed rate loans, right, we have one competitor, really, in Fannie Mae, and that competitor was twice our size and had been doing quite well. The whole mortgage market started to become very, very crowded. In fact, employment in the mortgage market increased, I think, quite substantially, and it got to be a very, very competitive market. So we didn't have the option, particularly given that we were a shareholder-owned corporation with all the obligations that any shareholder company had. We didn't have the option of just saying we're going to take a time out.
Right.
And then we'll come back after the time out. We had to sort of muddle through as we were fixing things. I mean, it was a challenge.
But at what? So are you saying that you were trying to improve the business at each step along the way?
Absolutely.
What were some of the challenges of the business?
Well, some of the challenges
and the times they started to come.
Yeah,
to the
some of the challenges of the business is, let me give you one that just has to do with Fannie Mae, which had to do with our securities, right? because everything has to do with the price of money and securities in this. Sometime earlier, certainly before I got there, Freddie Mac had changed the time duration of its securities on its mortgage-backed securities, and I think they were mortgage-backed, but they were in some securities anyway that were very important to us. And what happened was that Fannie Mae's duration, right, ended up becoming the standard in the market, so it became a preferred security. So it would often trade a couple of basis points richer than we would. And in that business, where you're bidding to the tenths of basis points in a lot of cases, that put us in a big disadvantage.
When you say your securities, what
MBSs, PCs, Freddie PCs versus Fannie MBSs?
Right, exactly.
So yours traded at a discount to
to
Fannie Mae.
Yeah, and see, and the other problem is that that this is a business that has certain economies of scale to it, right? And Fannie Mae was twice our size, right, by market share with the GSEs. And at least it was my concern that if it got to be three or four times our size, then we'd just impossible for us to compete, because the way that the business worked is usually originators, right, worked with one of the GSEs, and it had to do with the friendliness, if I can call it that, of their ability to hook up and send information to what I call the pipes. And if you got to the point where everyone was using Fannie pipes, right, and no one was using your pipes, they're not going to go to the effort to say, well, we'll send this deal to Freddie, right, instead of to Fannie, because they might not have a hookup that allowed them to do that.
Let me ask a question there, if I may. Were you there when Wells decided to go with Freddie?
And you can you tell me what that date was? I was.
It was 2000. I guess it might have been 2003. It might have been.
No, then I wasn't there. Yeah.
But it was my understanding Wells not only decided to go with Freddie instead of Fannie, but also wanted it to be well known, because Freddie was the friendlier company in other dimensions besides hooking up the pipes. But you didn't feel any of that people would prefer Freddie, if only because Fannie was such a dominant firm?
You know, it's a very interesting question, because you'd talk to everyone and everyone would say, we have to have two vibrant competitors in this world, right? But then if the other vibrant competitor comes in and their bid is half a basis point lower, right, your immediate business need as compared to the public policy idealized world suddenly takes precedence. Mm-hmm. And people went, this stuff's a commodity. I mean, it's almost the ultimate in commodities in a way. And people would go where they could get the best deal. And they would negotiate hard for deals, and deals were done usually for a year's period, right? But people would start negotiating for, say, 2006, as soon as they had the deal for 2005 done. You know, I mean, it was an ongoing process, and when you entered into a contract, you entered into a contract for the forthcoming year. So you had to do some implicit element of forecasting what was going to happen in the coming year.
Was there any way, given that you and Fannie were both backed by the same perception of government support, to make your PCs fungible with Fannie's MBS?
Oh, boy, did we work on that. We spent a lot of time looking at that and trying to do a variety of things. And I'm not a security specialist, but all I know is I spent time talking to people about it. We had reviews on it and things. I mean, I had a simplistic view at one point, and this really is simplistic, of saying, well, just change them, you know, just make it the same thing. And for some reason, we couldn't do it. But we were working on it very hard, but
what were some of the fundamental differences?
fundamental difference was, as I recall, in the payment period, the duration of the security, I think their duration of the security was a little shorter than ours was, right? And that people preferred dealing with it became the common denominator. See, the Fannie security became the common denominator in the market, and when people would quote the market, they'd quote it essentially in terms of Fannie's security. And then we come along and we say, well, no, we don't want the bid. We're not going to give you a bid in dollars. We're going to give you a bid in francs, right? It was always, well, I've got to calculate, you know, what the difference is. And just because you're not in as deep a market, right, one, given their size, and two, given the security difference, it gave a liquidity advantage to their security. The common term for this was security price performance.
So Freddie was in a position of always taking a discount, which had some compressed margins.
We had the margins really were compressed. We had, I can't remember the acronym for it, but we had a program in which we would pay people, we'd rebate them the difference to make up for how the securities traded. Okay. But that meant for. This is really where the rubber meets the road, because it meant for any particular piece of business, right, Fannie would make significantly more money on that piece of business than we would.
Right.
Which is not a great position to be in when you had a lot of problems, which we did, and that you're the smaller player in the market.
Had a long-term sustainability problem.
There was a long-term sustainability problem. Yeah.
You mentioned that your customers were concentrated, right? There was a limited number of big players you had to deal with.
The whole industry was very concentrated.
Right. So
did you perceive that to change over the period?
Yeah, it became more concentrated. I forget who they went with, but I remember ABN AMRO, who was one of our customers, left and went with someone else. I think maybe they went with Chase, but who was a Fannie customer. But places were in substantial measure either Fannie shops or Freddie shops. Now, I didn't think, I don't know, relevant to what you want, I didn't think that made any sense. I mean, I thought it was better for everyone, right? I mean, if both companies competed sort of continuously for each pair of business, it was more like each piece of business was more like an auction market, right? Mm-hmm. And instead of doing this 1 year ahead of thing, which was, I'm told, right, Leland Breslin's idea that he put in, that if each piece of business was bid for specifically on a sort of an ongoing market kind of way, the advantage of that would be you could change the terms of the contract. Either side could change the terms of the contract because it would be sort of rolling, right, rather than being stuck with what you agreed to a year before. Could I get some water by chance?
Yeah. Well, this is from an office. Somebody's got to have a bottle of water in the back.
Thanks, Alexa. Some.
Borrow. Pledge.
Off balance sheet transaction involving
pledge
water.
Pledge collateral.
We'll have a water sieve.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. It'll come back shortly.
Okay, thank you.
So you come into Freddie Mac. The systems need remediation. You got a big competitor, and margins are becoming compressed because of that, and because
in our costs. Don't forget our costs with carrying all those. Excuse me, carrying. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Not okay.
But carrying all those consultants, everyone else. I mean, there were people making quite nice livings off Freddie Mac.
Thank you.
So you had that, oh. And you had your customers getting stronger.
Right.
In terms of bargaining power.
Right.
What was your response to that? What did you decide to do in response to that?
Well,
or did you do anything?
Well, no. One, we decided to try to become somewhat more customer-centric, I mean, in the sense of talking to our customers, because we had a reputation of, you know, like Henry, a little bit like Henry Ford, you can have it any color you want as long as it's black. We had not spent a lot of effort just even talking to them, so we had sort of foregone opportunities, because there was some relationship aspects of this. I mean, people, you know, were used to working with one or the other, and they worked with them for years, and they liked them. So worked on that, and then I tried to see what we could do. Though it took a long time, and we weren't really that successful in it, in improving the connectivity, our connectivity to others. I don't know that this makes any difference. I tried to be more available and out and seeing customers and seeing what we should do. And I tried a little bit to take a view of, well, what should this look like as an industry as a whole? Because, I mean, you'd never make this up again. no, you wouldn't. I mean, there's so many things. You know, there were a lot of things that could have been done, I think, to make it the whole industry more efficient. But people had made good livings on it for a while, and they were sort of cemented in their ways to some extent.
When you say connectivity, one of the issues that was in the minds of a number of originators was the idea they wanted to use their own automated underwriting system and not Fannie's or Freddie's. And to what extent did you make changes in that dimension? And
I can't quantify from memory exactly, but we made some changes and became more quote unquote user friendly from that perspective.
How could you, if somebody used their underwriting system, how could you be sure that the mortgages were coming in within your credit parameters?
Well, you had reps and warranties on all of these things, and you had a post-factum quality control mechanism, and you could put product back to them, right? So we would audit product after as it came in, and we would put product back.
Was that a big problem? Was there a lot of?
There's a lot of tension about it. You know, I mean, at this whole time, the industry, don't forget, there's this huge flow of savings into the United States, right? I mean, Ben Bernanke that talked about that we had a savings glut, right? And everyone is chasing yield, right? So there's this big pressure going on at the time, which made everyone very sensitive to anything that you do that would affect costs.
Let's come forward a little bit closer now to the financial crisis.
Oh, sure. If I can ask one question. You said something intriguing, and you said it two different ways. One was it was a big mistake taking Fannie off budget. And the second was nobody would have designed this system to work this way. I'm curious what you think about the GSE as a business model.
I don't think it's a good business model. And, you know, before I went there, but that's my problem, right? I did some due diligence, right? But I did due diligence mostly around the accounting stuff that had been there. I didn't know, right, that it had the number of business problems that it had. And I certainly didn't know that it was, this is a shame on me, you know, it was as politically a third rail as it was. I mean, it was incredibly politicized. I was surprised coming from a private, strictly private, you know, manufacturing company about how it was. In terms of the business model, right, I think the problem that you had, the primary problem that you had, was there was this thing that actually worked fairly well for a while that was developed during the Great Depression, right, It had certainly people's expectation that its obligations were fully guaranteed, with moral obligations of the U.S. They may have been full faith and credit. I didn't remember at the time. When the company became a privately traded company, right, that perception remained. So you had this odd duck, right? First of all, it's a corporation that's not chartered under the laws of any state, right? It's federally chartered. Its shares are held by the general public, and you have the same obligation to your shareholders that every other company has. But on the other side of, on the other side of the equation, you have an expectation by a lot of your debtors, right, that the government's going to make good on the debt side if there's a problem. So you had this conflict in obligations.
You also had mission.
Just before we get to mission, on the debt side, that should have been an advantage, right? You were able to raise money more.
It was an advantage. Well, it wasn't an advantage vis-a-vis Fannie.
Correct. Okay.
So keep going on the business model before the digression, just to finish that.
No.
We can go to that.
So you had. You had this conflict between what your objectives were, and then I think there is a legitimate question about whether you needed two of these institutions, and there are all kinds of ways you could deal with that. I mean, you could deal with it. To simply make one of them, right? Or you could have created a service bureau, which is an idea I had for a while, which says, you know, well, we both may need different front doors that people come to sell their mortgages, right? But it doesn't mean we can't have one great big same back room. I mean, someone can be making fenders for all the cars and producing with a different name on them, all the securities. But the There are a lot of opportunities for change in the structure. I mean, towards the end, I came up with an idea which I talked to some people about making it a co-op, in a sense, because you get this terrible problem now, what do you do with it? But having a co-op which would be owned on a sort of pro rata basis by the users. And they would contribute so much to insure the bonds, and you could do it either as a reinsurance facility or as a primary insurance facility.
You mean the originators, the people who are writing
the originators could have owned it. It could have been a utility. Sorry, I should have just said it more straightforward, but it could have been a utility.
You were going to say something about the conflict with the mission, so let's start.
Well, the issue with mission was. Yeah, and it's a conundrum. I mean, it's a conundrum that's going to have to be figured out now. But if you were going to have them, right, I suppose it was reasonable at some point that mission would get mixed up in it. But mission was very difficult because, to be quite candid, I mean, you started to run short of mission-rich product. Of enough stuff that would satisfy your mission demands. You had orders from HUD, right, which continuously escalated the share of your business that was to low and moderate income, and then there was this, I can't name them all, but they broke down the goals to three primary goals and three sub-goals, and in doing that, it created a lot of angst over how you would make mission in one area as compared to making it in another area, and would you be able to make the mission at all? We made it all the years except for those one sub goal we missed in 1 year. But there started to be a paucity. gold-rich product out there at the same time that the demand for golds was going up.
Well, HUD is not known in this town, if I can say that, please don't quote me, as one of the stronger federal agencies. What was, I mean, and also the statute says, by the way, if a goal is infeasible, you don't need to do it. So,
yeah, no, but, well, now that's not exactly the way it was put to me. I mean,
I'm looking at the law. I
mean, I'm not saying you're wrong. As I understood it, right, that if you didn't meet a goal, right, HUD could impose a quote-unquote housing plan, right, which told you how you would meet the goal the next year. I mean, they would dictate how you ran your business.
Actually, with all due respect, the statute says Freddie shall submit a plan and HUD shall approve it.
Okay.
Not that HUD shall impose a plan on Freddie.
Oh, I probably, no, I knew we had to have a housing plan, right. But I may have had the order on. But it wasn't considered from a business perspective at all desirable to be in a situation where you had to, look, I mean, you have shareholders here, right? You got regulators here. They've got their own objectives, and you got a mission regulator, and all those objectives are not going to be in concert.
Okay.
And that's what made it such a difficult place. And my perception was, I don't know if I thought that. I think you're probably right. I probably thought that we had to produce a housing plan, and they would spoon, but. You know, it's sort of like the Paris Peace Table. You know, I mean, it's you have to do something, and they have to approve it, so they can get you to do pretty much what they want you to do.
Okay.
Let's get forward to the financial crisis. Why did Freddie fail?
Freddie failed because. In my mind, it was a non-diversified one-product company. Now I'm talking both sides of the business, the portfolio side and the guarantee side. But its only product, in a way, was guaranteeing U.S. mortgages, right? And U.S. mortgages. I've been teaching this course for the last year and a half at BC on financial crises, so I've read a lot about stuff back to, you know, there were derivatives.
I love the syllabus of that course.
there were derivatives back in Rome. But at any rate, the story was that we were a one-product company, right? There was this enormous flow of capital into. This is the proximate story. I mean, I can give approximate class. I can give you as an economist, but you don't want to hear, you know, the.
I really hear the CEO story.
Okay. We were a one product company, right? The price you were able to charge for that product, the insurance premium, right, kept going down. It was under pressure for a lot of period because we'd had when I think when I got there, our loss ratio was one half of one basis point. You know, it was, and people were all screaming at us about our fees were too high. Everyone screaming about us that our fees were too high. They had developed a bubble in U.S. housing prices. Now, the reason I think they developed a bubble in U.S. housing prices is bubbles beget bubbles. And what do I mean by that? We had had a bubble before, right, in stock prices, dot-com prices and other things, and we had really pretty accommodative monetary policy. And at the same time, we had the world's largest emerging country, China was dumping money into the United States, right, because they wanted to buy us to buy their products. I mean, we were absorbing 80% of world savings. So you had, again, you had all these dollars looking for deals, people chasing yield, right? And they said, well, what product seems pretty safe? And housing seemed pretty safe because there hadn't been any national decline in housing prices since the Great Depression. And, you know, gee, it's amazing. You know, hindsight's 2020. There are a few people, Bob Shiller certainly was there, But there were not very many people, right, that thought we were going to go into a crash in housing prices. And in fact, I think both the chairman of the Fed and the secretary of the Treasury were on record as saying that not too long before it happened. Because of this, people invested a lot of money in housing. There were a lot of bonds issued. We guaranteed a lot of those bonds. At the time, price-to-value ratios were very good. That changed around. In every kind of panic that you get a period of sort of euphoria, and then a leveling off, and then once the leveling off starts, someone says, "Well, you know, maybe I should sell some of this stuff," and they go to sell it, and it turns out you can't sell it at the price that you thought you could sell it at. You could sell it only at a price that was lower, and once that starts, you get the whole spiral downwards. I mean, you remember at this time it was just crazy. I mean, you could turn on the TV at night, and you had flip this house, right? I mean, there were people telling people, "How do you buy condos and fix them up and flip them, or finance them and flip them?"
Let me ask, if I may, ask if you could do something difficult, particularly since you're now teaching this course.
Okay.
To go back to your mindset back in 04, 05, 06,
right,
and what of this was perceptible then?
Very little. I would say there was the beginning of a shadow, but in 04, 05, there still was, you know, there was still a lot of froth, and there was still a lot of expectations on people's part that housing prices were going to keep going up. And, you know, it's not just keep going up. People just didn't conceive of them coming down. You know, they thought, well, the rate of acceleration may level off, but they're actually declining. Wasn't a very likely event.
Freddie was well known, in contrast to Fannie, incidentally, for the quality of its financial analysis, the analytics shop.
Mm-hmm.
What were they saying back then?
That's an interesting question. There's been a lot of discussions about this. They were saying they did not expect a decline in housing prices.
Interesting.
At least not nationally. No, we had all kinds of chat books and different kinds of things, and you know, we had a lot of data on what was happening in one part of the country. We were a little worried about the upper Midwest, but it was worried about the upper Midwest. I was worried about it because of its fundamental economics and what was happening to the auto industry, not because of kind of a cyclical phenomenon in a commodity, right?
Mm-hmm.
But no, that's a very good question, because we had a lot of discussions about that, and they didn't expect that there was going to be a, it wasn't. Unfortunately, there weren't people running around saying Chicken Little that the ceiling is going to fall in on housing prices.
The answer you gave was more of an economist, I thought, than a CEO, if you don't mind me saying so. Specifically, what was it at Freddie Mac that caused the losses that caused the failure of Freddie Mac?
Oh, what was it at Freddie Mac was that delinquencies went up, right? The fair value of the housing backing up a lot of the bonds went down, right? And the technical issue was that we, and at least in some forecasts, now this is controversial. I mean, we were working on this till the last minute, and it depended on how things went. But I think it's safe to say that no monoline company insuring housing values could have survived this, because you couldn't have got the premium, you know, up forward that would have carried you through this kind of period. And you know, just go back to the point that you were kind enough to make. I think if you look now and at what the loss ratios of different Fannie, Freddie's are pretty low. I mean, they're at the low end of the range, And so it shows even that the cautious one, if you want to put it that way, was too optimistic.
Okay. Is there any part of the answer as to why Freddie failed that has to do with the fact that they didn't have much of a cushion?
Capital?
Capital.
I think it would have been, given what really happened in the outcome, in the event, I think it would have been hard to have enough capital to have survived, for anyone to have had enough capital to survive, because of how deep the drop was. But certainly if we'd had more capital, it would have acted as a cushion, and it would have probably stretched out the period of time. We were in the process of wanting to raise capital during this period, but we couldn't do it. The lawyers told us we had to be very, very careful in doing this because we were registering with the... You remember, we did do one preferred offering, right? Then we were going to do another preferred offering, but we were in the process of registering with the SEC at the time.
When are you talking now?
2007.
Yeah.
The Freddie 2007 annual report indicates there was a stock buyback program that was instituted in early 2007 and completed...
I didn't think in 2007 there was a... I thought there was in 2006, but... Where is this?
Oh, thank you,
right
guys.
Right at the very top. Issue or purchases. I have one.
Authorized.
One more. Which one of you wants?
Well, I guess there had been a stock. I know that there have been... I knew that definitely, obviously, had been one, but I thought it had been in the end of 2006, but it was up into 2007. See, this is a funny business. Actuarially, right, if you looked at it, maybe not actuarially, but the amount of capital... given that you had the kind of market that we had at the time that these decisions would have been made, and at the time even that they would have been carried out, the amount of capital that we had looked pretty adequate. But we went out and issued, we did that preferred issue towards the end of 2007, didn't we?
I think so, yes.
And we were planning on doing another one because we had an agreement with the Secretary of the Treasury that we would go out and raise some more capital. And we fully planned on doing that, but we couldn't do it while we were registering with the SEC because all the lawyers told us, oh, my God, you're going to get... What happens if someone sends from the SEC something over that says that you have to change something and you've got an ISS? What's the right term?
I'm not sure. I'm not really... I don't understand what you're saying.
I think Dick is paraphrasing legal advice, which is not one of his areas of strength.
No.
That you had an offering out. That you had an offering out.
You could. The gist of it is...
You were in registration.
Before, no. While you're in registration, you don't issue securities until the registration is complete. That's the issue that he's remembering. That's what he's told me before, at least.
So was this a private placement, the preferred stock?
Yes.
That was a provided, and then you had a registration statement on that you were trying to get effective with the SEC?
Right.
But the registration statement was to register the company, the whole company. Don't forget the company.
Okay, so this was not a capital raising exercise.
Right.
It was
It was a
34 Act registration.
Exactly, Bob. And as you'll recall, I think it was part of the deal that was made to resolve the accounting problems that the company would, quote, voluntarily register with the SEC and become an SEC registrant because the statute had exempted them from that in the past. And what Dick was struggling through in 6-7 and really up into 08 was to get the company registered under the 34 right. Act. And the lawyers, I believe, he's told me before, the lawyers told him, we do not want to be making a public offering of securities while your registration is pending at the SEC. I don't know the dates, but I think it was pending there for some time.
Oh, it was pending for a long time, and there were questions. There were questions that I don't recall now all the details of them, but about specific parts of registration, like tax carry forwards, AOCI, all other consolidated income. I mean, it was a complicated deal. And AFAO spent a lot of time looking at it, and the SEC spent a lot of time looking at it.
Do you have any recollection as to how long this would have been from the time you filed with the SEC to the how long they played with it?
The SEC was pretty good. I mean, the holdup that we had in time was more with AFAO. Now I don't know if we had a piece of paper sitting there while while we were debating a lot of these accounting issues with AFAO, but. I'm going to be guessing.
How did AFAO get involved in the SEC registration? Or was it
AFAO was involved in everything. And given the problems that the company had had, it's understandable. But they went through the full registration statement process with us, in effect. I mean, they looked at what we were going to do, and we had to deal with spent a lot of time dealing with their chief accountant, and then they had other outside accountants that they hired into the process to look at things, and
so they were still quibbling over whether or not the books were right.
Yes.
Again, with due respect, I want to give you a Washington Post article, and unfortunately, I didn't make copies, but I'll give it to you. March 13, 2008, following the shareholders' investor conference that you presided at, Chief says Freddie won't raise capital. Mortgage financier cites responsibility to shareholders, won't increase loan capacity, and the one critical sentence in a briefing for investors and stock analysts in New York, Chief Executive Richard Syron cited management's fiduciary responsibilities in suggesting Freddie Mac will put shareholders first and resist pressure to raise more capital.
Yeah, I think I know this, and I think...
This is after the registration is completed.
Right, but in all due respect...
your chance.
In all due respect, someone threw bait out, and I rose to it, but I didn't rise to it on this. Someone had raised the question that, well, Fannie is much more shareholder-friendly. It takes into consideration the interests of its shareholders more than Freddie does, and... I think I can recall. I should probably should read. Let me say.
Go for it. I'm sorry.
No, I think, and I'm quite certain that we would not bow to any company in putting the interests of their shareholders first. In other words, we wouldn't be worse than any company in putting the interests of our shareholders first. Freddie Mac, Washington.
I just sort of read about four paragraphs down there. There's a short paragraph talking about you and the investor conference.
We were perennially torn by competing demands.
Yeah,
that's the one. We wouldn't bow to any company. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's a recording.
I don't know.
It was during a Q&A.
Okay. But the concept that I was trying to grapple with is, I mean, it's a matter of arithmetic that the more stock one has, the less ROE one has, at least in good times.
Right.
And that seemed to be what that story was saying you were saying.
It wasn't saying that was what I was saying particularly. I mean, what it was saying was, as I said, someone had come up to me and had said, was complaining that... We were more less shareholder friendly than Fannie Mae, right? I didn't think that was necessarily the case. Okay. Now I remember the whole thing. Yeah, and I didn't say I wouldn't attach a high priority to meeting federal quota. I did say, and I said it, I think it's in one of our annual reports, I think it was 2007, 2006, because we had seen this movie before. I mean, we'd seen this movie, I saw this movie when I was president of the Boston Fed.
Actually, one of our colleagues wants to ask you about the parallels at some point, but we'll wait for that.
Okay. That, you know, at some point, these goals become effectively predatory because you're going to be making loans to people that that really shouldn't be getting them. And you're not doing anyone a favor to have them make a loan to them only to have the house repossessed later on and for them to lose their down payment and their credit status.
We made public a Fannie Mae document from 2007. A 2007 strategic planning document where Fannie Mae basically says the goals are starting to ratchet up, exactly what you were saying. We may need to talk to HUD.
Yeah.
Because HUD presumably wouldn't want predatory loans to be made in the name of what it was trying to tell Freddie Mac to do.
That's right. And I think we both had that same view on talking to HUD. And I will say that it was Johnson was Secretary of HUD at the time. Jackson?
Yes, Jackson.
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 That when I went to see him several times about different things and made the point about that, he seemed to understand it. I mean, but he understood also what their obligation was, but he seemed to understand the goals in the first place, as I understand it, were just sort of picked out of the air, and then I'm not aware of a lot of sophisticated analysis that was generated to say how much they should go up a year.
More is better.
Yeah. Always.
Can I take a second to read this?
Sure.
But we don't need to go. We don't need to dwell on it.
Well, I'd like to dwell on it just a minute because it sounds to me like it's all about the conflict between the mission and the duty to shareholders. It sounds to me like the. What he's saying is, we're as shareholder-friendly as everybody else.
That's essentially what I was saying. I remember clearly saying we will bow to no company. And it was pretty clear I had one company in mind. But
they actually quote you in there, but what they say is you will bow to no one. And they kind of extend the reasoning to regulators.
I know. I talked to Lockhart about this. I definitely didn't. I don't have the transcript.
You made the point.
Could it have been one? I said instead of company, but I definitely meant company. It was definitely
forget about the word, Dick. I mean, is the point that there really was a tension between the regulator's pressure for capital and your obligations to shareholders?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, that holds true in a lot of financial institutions, but it held true very much. I mean, just think about it.
I don't think we're talking about the regulators.
Well, just say, let's let me finish.
The whole GSE model, I won't say Freddie model, if you look at it, right? I mean, with the amount of capital set in statute, and we had an override on that, right, was built on the idea that you were insuring, it was like the big bazooka comment, you know, once you had the bazooka, you didn't need it, but that you were insuring these securities backed by mortgages, and once they were insured, they were unlikely to come under pressure. So it was built on a very high leverage philosophy, right? As a matter of fact, our leverage wasn't during most of the time wasn't pushing the requirements of the statute.
I guess the question then becomes the role of the CEO. And the degree to which one wishes to place great faith, let me state this gently, in the wisdom of the world's greatest deliberative body to set numbers like that into statute.
Yeah, well, see, the other thing that's happening during this period of time is the amount, don't hold me to exactly these numbers, but I think financial services as a share of GDP grew from 4% to 7%. right? The financial markets became very, very crowded, right? Money was coming here from all over the world. Financial standards, to be quite candid about it, for lending for all products declined. You know, there was just, it was just, as they said, it was dollars chasing deals. And in that period, those are the people that you had to compete with. So it was a market that was less disciplined than it had been in other periods. But the problem you have is if you're in that market, and believe me, you do believe it, I think, well, the trying to balance the interest of the shareholders, right, the interest of the regulator and your mission obligation all at the same time was a continuous problem. I mean, it was, economists would call it a mini-max problem, but I mean, what you wanted to do was, to the extent you could minimize the number of people unhappy with you, you were never going to maximize people happy with you. Because they say you go raise a whole lot of capital, your shareholders are all ticked off, right? Mm-hmm. And also potentially emission people, because you know another way to do it is just to cut back on what you're doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were inherent conflicts, and I think that was the underneath everything what the problem was. And I think if you guys, and I guess you are going to get into what this is. Looks like going forward, I think it absolutely would, if it continues to exist, it has to be on the budget. This idea of having, people have used less kind terms for it, but this idea of having an implicit guarantee on non-budgeted obligations. And of course, it's the same problem we have now. I mean, with too big to fail, and people. I don't think there are an awful lot of people running around out there that think that if there was a big run generated internationally on J.P. Morgan or Citicorp tomorrow, that the U.S. government would let it fail.
So by it, you mean the GSE model? That's really what you're getting at. Thank you.
I'm sorry if I obfuscated.
No, you haven't obfuscated.
No, I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to use the word obfuscated. I meant once circularly. I'll claim.
Can I talk about this?
We may as well go through the because it seems to be a logical consequence of what.
Thank you.
Let me give you one first. Go ahead. I think I've got one more. We didn't know how many people were going to be here. I just wanted to go through a few pages. This is the...
Giving somebody mine, it's all marked up.
2007 Board of Directors
maybe
meeting.
Maybe not. No, I haven't. That's all right. I have an extra one.
Mark, do you have one? I have one. Tom's got one. We're all good.
We're all good.
Why don't we go to just a few pages on this. Page 9. And I think this is what you were telling us. I take it this was, you recognize this document from your time?
I recognize that there are a lot of documents like this. I recognize that I couldn't recite for you what this says, but I'm pretty sure I saw this in a...
looks like a legitimate presentation to the Board of Directors on or about March of 2007?
Yeah.
So if we go to page 9, and I'll just read the headings and get any reactions... Some of our current purchases have subprime-like risk.
Mm-hmm.
Fair statement?
I think it's a fair statement, save one issue, and that is we classified things as subprime or non-subprime on the basis of the channel that they're originated from. Because you can get two loans, right? One originated by say, AmeriQuest, right? Mm-hmm. The other originated by Wells Fargo or something like that, and they can have the same characteristics, but the one that comes up through a subprime channel, is much more likely to cause you problems than the one that comes through from a regular prime producer.
Even if it has the same loan characteristics.
Oh yeah, Oh, yeah. And it has to do with, I think, just the way people are informed about things. And one concern we had about the subprime origination channel, if I can call it that, you know, the people you'd see at 11 o'clock at night on TV telling you, you know, you can borrow now, don't worry about not being able to get the money, we'll get it to you by the morning, that they were more likely to engage in predatory kinds of activities. And there were certain things we wouldn't do. For example, we wouldn't, did lead the market doing some good things, like saying that we wouldn't buy loans that had in them a requirement that you have life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that was the old
credit life problem. Same thing with prepayments, big prepayment penalties, and a lot of stuff.
And was Fenny along with you on that, or was there an issue where you had to go out and tell your customers we're simply going to take a position here, and if you got to go to Fenny, you got to send that stuff to Fenny?
That was pretty. There was some stuff, right, that we just felt. I think it's fair to say that if you were to, there was some survey of predatory sensitivity, right? That we were much more sensitive. That we were more sensitive to predatory behavior than Fannie.
Okay.
I don't want to defame them, but I mean, I just.
Can you say why?
Yeah, because ultimately. These things were creatures of the government, right? I mean, the only two, or maybe there was something else someplace else, GSEs, state-chartered institutions, federally chartered institutions, they had special privileges, right? I mean, when they had privilege on state income tax, and they had this big privilege on people thinking that the mortgages were guaranteed, right? And, you know, in that environment, right, it just doesn't seem right. Probably not right in any environment, but it just doesn't seem right. I'll give you an example of that. In 2007, right, we had someone come in. I'll tell you, I can say it here, where they were from, was for a planning session from Bear Stearns. And they told us, and I hadn't understood this before, how these 228 and 327 mortgages work. I mean, I said, oh, my God, you know, we can't do this. And I said, the next day, we're not doing this anymore. And we put out, and we did lead the market in that. We put it out before, and we had customers that weren't happy. And we didn't, I certainly didn't, see, that's another problem. Yeah. Antitrust issues. I certainly didn't have conversations with Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae beforehand. But we said, I'm not saying I'm a saint, but I'm just saying, you know, that was pretty extreme stuff.
What about the presentation raised the red flags for you? Do you remember?
Oh yeah. What about the presentation that raised the red flag was when they said, well, you go and you make the loan to this person, right? This entity, right? They have, because their house is appreciated, they're over collateralized now, right? So you make the loan to them at a teaser rate, right? And at this teaser rate, they get probably paying a lower rate, right? And they're getting more money, they're getting money out, and they can do whatever they want with it. But then, 2 years later, say it's a 228, it's tied to LIBOR and some index, and all of a sudden it goes up above that. And they say, well, it's not a problem because your house will continue to go up in price. So if I got a deal for you, number two, you know, I'm going to give you another teaser loan, teaser rate loan. It's going to be for more money, right? And it's, you know, it's circling on up. But the person all along is getting further and further into debt. And for the originator, whoever was putting the whole thing together, it's a great deal because don't forget, if when they come back and pay the loan off that period of time, I think you get favorable accounting treatment because it's no longer a 30-year non-amortizing loan. You get to take it over 2 years or 5 years. I mean, it's just a money machine. But you could see what the result could and was.
Did Bear go down the street and talk to somebody else, you know?
You know, I didn't. There was a woman that came up from Bear to talk to us and tell us about it. And you know, I didn't go running out and saying anything about Bear.
No.
But within the next two or three days, we did. I think it was the next two or three days. It was a short period of time.
Going back to page 9, isn't the premise of page 9 that we're already taking on subprime risk, but we're not subprime-like risk, but we're not getting compensated for it as if it were subprime?
Well, I think its premise is that its margins were really being squeezed. I mean, this was not a terrific business.
The business you were now doing. But isn't it at the bottom it says we received considerably lower prices than if we were in the subprime loans directly? Isn't that the premise of this page?
Well, he didn't write this, so
No, but it's gone to the board, and I assume he was there when it was explained.
Yeah, that doesn't. Well, that's 3 years. That's, you know,
true.
I couldn't remember what I had for lunch yesterday. So I mean, if you're asking him what he remembers the discussion was at the board 3 years ago, I think that's not an appropriate question, because he can't remember it.
But I'm going to have to say that Mr. Green is right.
Okay, we're not trying to push recollections harder than they will go.
Do you remember overall what the purpose of this presentation is?
The purpose of the presentation was that, there's this fix we're in. It was one of several presentations like that, and you know, what can we do to get out of it? And there was a difference of opinion in the organization. I mean, there were some people who wanted to go explicitly, if I can say that, into subprime, right, and say that subprime was an adjacency where we could make money. I didn't want to do that, right, just because I thought at some point the subprime stuff. Could turn troublesome.
Let's talk about that, because the conclusion of this document is this is where we want to go as Freddie Mac.
But we didn't do that.
Okay, that's good to know.
No, I mean, there were some people. Look, you get tensions in every organization. The people that were in charge of originating loans and dealing with the customers, they're hearing all the time from the customers, you guys have got to get into this. You've got to get into it.
Why would a presentation then go to the board that says, let me go to that page rather than spending time on the intermediary, that basically says, and why don't we start at page 70. Why don't we start at page 70? And I'll skip the intervening.
What's the question? Why did someone propose that to the board?
Well, I assume the CEO would have had something to do with the strategic plan that would go to the board.
Yeah, but you know,
why don't you ask him that?
Why don't I ask you that?
Yeah, okay.
Does the CEO have anything to do with the strategic plan going to the board?
Yes, but I didn't necessarily rule things in and out. I was very open that way. And let me tell you one reason I was very open that way. My predecessor, right, when they got into these accounting problems, it turns out that he had had many dress rehearsals before board meetings, right? Someone used the number 20. I can't believe that, but he had a lot of. It was a packaged product by the time it came to the board. I took the view that people ought to be. You had to take the view that people ought to be able to present what they thought, because look. I mean, there's a lot of conflicting thoughts here. I mean, you'd have at loan and credit, that's the Federal Reserve term, at credit meetings or audit meetings, you know, things presented that you wouldn't necessarily agree with, right? But just because I didn't agree with it, I didn't tell people that they couldn't present it.
Great. That's very helpful. Then I'm going to set the document aside and move on to one.
There's a footnote to this. There's a more aggressive version of this that was presented by BlackRock at an off-site management meeting.
Yeah.
That really some of these slides that go to the board are borrowed from the BlackRock presentation.
But I guess I just made an assumption that the CEO would want the choices before the board.
No.
Set forth.
No, but and actually, you can.
That's fine.
You can check with people that worked for me and were board members of companies that I was with, and I was always, you know, if an idea has can be, if a senior person has an idea that they feel strongly about, that somebody on the board might think it merit, they can present it.
Great. We're not going to challenge that. We're here to hear you, not to quibble. I do have one other set, one other document, and unfortunately, I only have one copy. That's strange. No, not that one. I better have two copies because I wanted you to be able to. Oh, here it is. I want to know if you ever saw this. Over here, let me give you this one because I have my notes there. It's September 4th, 2008. Letter from Christopher Dickerson, Acting Deputy Director at Federal Housing Finance Agency, the financial regulator, to you, saying, here's our mid-year letter in draft.
Time to look at it.
Sorry.
I just don't take his time to look at it.
Absolutely.
So very busy time, September 4th.
And I'm not going to ask you to, I'm just curious whether this, in fact, was delivered to you. It looks like it. It's signed. And then I just want to get your reactions to some of the things they say in the document.
I think I know what this letter is. Can I ask counsel a question?
Yeah, sure.
You want to
step out? Sure. For the transcriber, there is a break, temporary break.
If you like, Tom, I can put us off record for a minute.
Yeah, let's do that.
Well, we have two tape recorders, so I just...
Yeah, it's 11:50. We'll use this one as the official.
Okay.
And I'll...
Put that one off, too. Just hit the red button.
All right, it's noon. We're back on record.
So my first question is whether this was actually delivered to you while you were at Freddie Mac.
I got it. I don't remember how I got it. I remember I got it to... I got it late or something, but I remember that I read it.
And they have some serious concerns they express here, and what I'd like to do is go over a few of them, get your reactions.
All right. Can I give you a little background?
Absolutely.
On this document. This is September 4th, 2008. All right. You'll note that the document is draft, right?
Yeah.
Confidential. And you'll also undoubtedly note there's no final signed copy of it.
Right.
Right. That was left in draft. If you read the first part of Paulson's book, because everyone's got a book, he talks in there about how he was going to approach Mudd and myself, and he didn't like to do it, but he figured he couldn't just come up to us and say, I want to shut you down. You have to be prepared to ambush us. I think that's the word that's in there. He didn't like to ambush people, but... But at any rate, I do remember talking about this document with my board, and I remember I don't know the exact date, September 8th, whatever it was, when we went over, right, to the Treasury to see them. It was the day they were going to tell us that we weren't going to be no more, and they had. I don't know whether they have Fannie first or us first. Fannie has a letter that I think is very, very similar to this. And The reason I wanted to check with counsel, I want to be sure it's all right. What Paulson was telling some of our directors effectively was that this letter was a means, not necessarily an end. And you know, if we agreed to go into conservatorship, we were going to agree to go into conservatorship anyway. I mean, you had no reason. This letter really wouldn't come into play, and there was a very clear message that the letter was there as a mechanism to bring about a result. That's what I took from.
Okay.
Anyway.
So. That's fair. And what I'd like to do, and not go through it thoroughly, but just several different points they make and get your reaction. Was this a valid statement? Do you want to change it around a bit? And let me see. I just turned over a couple of pages here. Let's go to page 5. I'm just sort of curious whether the statements are accurate, and then if they are, why, what was going on. Let's take the first one. The board of directors failed to separate the positions of chairman of the board and CEO.
All right. We were looking for. I can address this in detail. I came in originally with a 5-year contract, right? And this was a result of, you know, what I wanted to do. My wife wanted me to do all this sort of thing. Part of doing this was that one of my responsibilities would be to recruit a successor, right? I did so. I recruited a guy named Gene McQuaid, and McQuaid had agreed to take over, I think it's the end of 2007. We had an agreement to take over. It was public knowledge. His contract was being negotiated and everything. And right about 2 or 3 weeks or something, and give me a few days latitude on that, he decided he didn't want to do it. Right? He changed his mind.
That would be when, in 2008?
No, it was in 2007.
Seven, okay.
Because he left in the fall of 2007, as I recall. But, I mean, if I had a calendar,
that's right.
I left all my, I don't have any of my stuff.
Okay.
At any rate, this threw things into a big, conundrum. What are we going to do? I, all along, had worked out a situation where he was going to become CEO, right, and I was going to stay as chairman for at least a year. I don't know.
Oh, I see. So you didn't want to put somebody in the job.
No, it's worse than that. Once he told us no, right, I spent a lot of my time out trying to recruit people to take the job. In fact, I remember it was 2007, because I remember the 4th of July weekend talking to someone in Boston about this. Sahaba guy, he decided he didn't want to do it. But at any rate, we were comfortable separating the two, right? But what we didn't want to do was say, all right, Siren, what we're going to do with you is you'll be CEO, right, and we'll make Tom Johnson, who's our lead director, right, and we took lead director seriously, who's our lead director, we're going to make him chairman, right? Now, 3 weeks from now, or a month from now, when we were hopeful, and I can get you the name of the head hunter that did the whole thing, we get someone, and we're going to say that he's appointed president, and Johnson's leaving, and you become chairman again. And that was the whole thing. I didn't have any problem with the idea of separating chairman and CEO. I mean, the company I'd come to before taking the job, I was the chairman, and I was trying to do the model again. I had come into the company, it had some problems. And I had hired a whole lot of staff, and I hired this guy who had become CEO. And when he became CEO, I became chairman,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's what I was trying to do the whole thing over again, and we were trying not to botch it up. I don't have any problem separating chairman and CEO, and as a matter of fact, if you do it right, I think a lead director can sort of serve a lot of the purpose.
Thank you. Now, that's very valuable context. That's exactly what we were hoping for as we go down a couple of these things. And then they say, in May 2007, I guess it says down here, Mr. McQuaid would leave in September, and they're unhappy at the speed with which Freddie found a successor.
Yeah, let me tell you, I mean, you can imagine at this point, particularly, McQuaid was the smart one. no, he was. He was the smart one. At this point in time, you know, the rose had lost a little bit of the bloom. You'd call some people and talk to them, you'd call other people and say, what are you, out of your mind? So it was a tough search.
Thank you.
I really can't get all the... they can get all the notes and...
We're just trying to understand the context, and I greatly appreciate the way you're providing it. Let's go to the one that I talked about earlier, page 7, raising capital. And this, I guess...
Yeah, I'm a little ticked off at this because, you know... We were in a box. I should read it first before saying what I'm saying, but we were in a box on this. I mean, we were being advised by counsel that if you're in a registration process, right, the last thing you want to do is be out raising capital at the same time. That's it.
Let me ask then what they were trying to say. The CEO's explanations for this failure emphasize factors that were just as relevant in March 2008 when management committed to raise capital. And by the conclusion...
I can't see this.
The second paragraph
second
of the two,
full
the
paragraph.
First sentence.
Okay.
And so I'm curious what's going on there.
Second full paragraph.
I think you have to read both paragraphs because otherwise the second paragraph doesn't make sense.
Well, it does in terms of the answer.
I'm sorry, I see the sentence. I'm not sure I understand it.
They're basically saying the fact of, I assume, let me try to put words in their mouth, but I'm not sure that's right. Presumably that the factors you talked about of having a registration in process were true when the commitment was made, so they're unhappy assuming is dangerous, particularly in our business. But let's think that they might be saying, gee, why didn't you raise it then when you made this promise to us?
But it says, just as, when we committed to raise the capital to them, I think that we committed to do it, I think we did make it contingent on this. I mean, the whole thing. And as a matter of fact, you know, wait a minute. It's not that we weren't trying to raise capital through this whole period. In fact, right about in this time period, right, I was meeting with all kinds of people. We had Goldman working for us. We had Morgan working for us. We were working hard to see how we could raise private capital.
Got it.
And the problem that we had in raising private capital is it came down to this. People saying, well, because Bear Stearns had gone before this, Lehman hadn't happened. They're saying, wait a minute, yeah, but what happens to us if the government comes in and takes over? You know, we want if we will put in, and we had people that would put in money, but we want to be treated pari passu with the federal government. We don't want to come on. We've seen this trick before. We don't want to agree to put the money in week one, and week three you take the thing over and wipe out the preferred
about
chip.
When did that happen that the market started to worry about that?
Oh yeah, okay. Now let me see. This is, let's see, July.
Okay. Good. Why don't we go to? Well, let me ask a question on capital. We interviewed, and this is confidential, please. We interviewed Mr. Saxena, who was the chief risk officer, and he indicates that around in 2007, he was urging an increase in capital, mm-hmm. And that he thought he was overruled on that. Does that then feed into the?
No, I don't think. Look, we let's see if we can get our dates straight.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I have a terrible memory, so obviously, the dates. But we did the capital raise, the preferred capital raise. When did we complete that?
I'm not sure.
In 2007 is what this document says.
Is that it?
It says
certainly in the 2007 annual report.
Yeah.
Right. And then you had your registration on file on 2008, so
that's
you could
right.
go out and raise equity,
yeah, that,
right?
Exactly. I think to say he was overruled would be wrong. To say that people had different senses of timing than he did would be right.
Okay.
It's we knew we had to at some point raise capital. I think we did anyway.
Okay.
Best of my recollection. I mean, that's why I went to all these meetings with people. Now, they were in 2008, right, in the summer. Trying to raise capital.
Great, thank you. And then on page 11, the last item that I think is worth flagging, there a whole bunch, but this is giving us a good sense of the context. Credit risk management. Repeated urgings by FHFA, the first bullet, to improve overall credit governance practices. Enterprise operating without a chief credit officer and with credit-related internal management information systems and risk management processes that are not commensurate with the condition of the portfolio. This failing was discussed on several occasions with the CEO and the board and is an unsafe and unsound practice.
Well, we were trying to improve our credit management oversight all the time. I mean, it was from day one that was sort of going, you know, we didn't have a chief credit officer when I came in the regulars in the sense of enterprise risk, mm-hmm. you know, looking at operating risk, market risk, credit risk. There's another one, the exogenous event, you know, like a nuclear power or something. We didn't have one, and we were.
You mean you didn't have a chief risk officer? You said credit. You mean risk officer? Or you mean credit?
Well, Damian Draconis was serving as chief risk officer, as I recall, but I think his focus was mainly on credit risk. He wasn't, and at this point, don't forget, you go back to that point in the Freddie Mac history. So we're going back to 2004, right? Mm-hmm. Early 2005. All the concern was about the retained portfolio. There's hardly any concern about the guarantee business. All the concerns about the retained portfolio. And Andrew Conis really wasn't focused very much on the retained portfolio. He was a credit risk guy. And also he wasn't, not his fault. I mean, he hadn't come out of this background of looking at enterprise risk, operational risk, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Thank you. Those are the questions I have. So let me turn it over to. Why don't we ask? We said we were going to have one brief digression to talk about the similarities and differences from the credit crunch in the early 90s and now.
Sure.
And we would be very interested. Is that a fair
statement? Yeah, no, that's fair. No, my job is basically to kind of look at the roots of this whole story. It didn't all suddenly happen out of the blue. And given your perspective when you were at the Fed in Boston, I'm trying to sort of decide what are the key inflection points along the way in the 20, 25 years leading up to it that might have put the pieces in place that all fell down when 2008 occurred. What strikes you as fitting that? And that obviously 1991.
That's a good question.
Well, take the 1991.
It's a good question.
He's taught the class, so
no, actually, it was one of the reasons I liked the Boston Fed job, because it was interesting. I mean, because I was there through the credit crunch, and actually, it's the first person I think credited with the term that's credit crunch. That right. it was a credit crunch. That it wasn't just tightening in the market. I'll try not to digress too much. The credit crunch that we had in New England, right, had its origin in a way that was parallel in some broad sense to this, in that an awful lot of New England thrifts, right, had gone and raised money by converting from mutual to private. To stockholder status. Then they ended up they had all this money, right? And all that money's good, but what are you going to do with it, right? Interestingly, in the late 80s in New England, there was just a surplus of lending, right? Particularly in the commercial side, not so much on the household side. That surplus of lending led in a lot of the commercial banks. I think there were three or four large commercial banks in Boston at that time. Were looking for business, right? And it was again dollars chasing deals, and a lot of loans were made. There was a real, real bubble this is a regional thing commercial real estate. And then once that bubble collapsed, right, I mean, it really had a dramatic effect on a lot of institutions. I remember Shawmut Bank traded down to $2 at one point. The OCC came in, and the OCC was very, very tough. The OCC came in, they had just come out of Texas, where they had seen this movie in oil, okay? And we were seeing it for a different reason, they took a very harsh approach towards a lot of institutions. Long and the short of it is, we had only one large institution, Bank of New England, closed. But when I'm talking too much, tell me. But the issue is, as far as the credit crunch goes, even though if you have good opportunities, there will be new sources of credit that will come along. It takes time. And particularly for small and mid-sized businesses, right, they run in a lot of cases on knowledge that individual credit officers have of those businesses. And then they go out one day, right? Well, it's one thing you see as robot dealing for money, but if you're Patsy's Donuts, right, and you got 12 donut stands, what do I know about Patsy's Donuts? So it takes a longer time to put it into place. Credit standards tightened up a great deal, right? And it was really a prolonged regional recession. Now, the parallel to this, I think, was there was a big flow of money into, in this case, a national housing market, not a regional commercial building market. That caused ultimately a bubble and a break, as this did. It in turn led to a lot of institutions being in trouble. In this case, getting a lot of federal aid, and to go to our current situation, what's happened is, once burned, thrice cautious. That a lot of the people that were involved in making the loans before during the easy days, right? Now, to get a loan is just very, very difficult. I mean, I was looking at some commercial last night on TV or something, somebody talking about it. So it was the same kind of psychological phenomenon. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it surprises me, though, that so quickly after 90, what I'm actually interested in, the loosening of credit standards, which was a problem. You would think that what occurred to loosen, you know, that's...
You know, but when you have spare time, there's a great book called It's Different This Time.
Right.
And it is amazing to I would say, to almost everyone, how short the time can be for memories to fade and for people to come back in. I mean, it's just really quite surprising. And I guess all I can say about excuse or reason maybe why it happened is that one was in one part of the country, it was commercial real estate. There were some problems with the regional economy, right? And the other case was this asset class, housing, which is certainly kind of a blessed, it's treated as a sacred class of assets in the United States. And there hadn't been, as I said, a national decline in housing prices since the Great Depression, and I think people took comfort in that. I remember being in more conversations about, but there hasn't been. I mean, I remember going looking like a fool before a bunch of my friends, because it was an investor group in New England, and they wanted to know about a national, you know, was this a bubble or was it substantial? And I had all these charts prepared and everything, and I went up there and told them that it's there's regions that are in problem, but there's not going to be any national housing crash, right? Well, I've been reminded of that very frequently.
That's great, thank you.
I need to ask you a question from that period, because we're also looking at the whole question of regulators. Was a guy named Richard Randall at the Federal Reserve?
Dick Randall, yeah.
And
you worked for me.
Do you remember his story of? I can tell you my perception of it, but I'd prefer to hear yours.
I don't really.
Let me state what I understood and then get your reactions, because I believe there may be a parallel there, but I'd be interested. You've been very good when people state things of giving us context for it, and I'd appreciate that. The way I understood from Mr. Randall the problem was that you had a whole bunch of New England banks that were making an awful lot of money. They were booking fees up front.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, he was the vice president, head of supervision at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, and he started sounding the alarm. And the banks complained. How can... Do you recall? I see you nodding yes.
Well, I'm not sure exactly the title. He was a controversial fellow.
Okay.
He's very, very good. And actually we moved him to the research department because there were conflicts with people that he worked for in other parts of the bank, and he did a terrific job in the research department and actually made us come to the conclusion that you should always have a Randall in research, i.e. someone who knows the data.
Mm-hmm.
and really the, you know, someone who isn't just a book guy. But he did raise that, and I don't
know. And the banks complained, apparently.
Well, it isn't as if he went out and wrote an op-ed piece saying that everyone ought to tighten up. He was actually in loan and discount, not in regulation, not in supervision or regulation.
Okay.
And now it depends on what time. This was before I was president, I think.
I think that's right.
Okay, because I don't recall anyone ever coming up, bank coming up and complaining to me about him. But
that may have been. And in fact, I think that's right. Then what I was trying to get at was what appears to be a parallel, that it's very hard for a regulator to flag an institution that's making money hand over fist and say, wait a minute, something's wrong here. And I don't know if you have any observations on that from the New England experience.
No, I think that's true. And, you know, people will say to you all the time when you're in these situations, unless there's something really glaring, what are you, prescient? You know, I mean, how do you, you know, I have these shareholders to satisfy. How do I, well, I'm supposed to go on what you think is right? And I remember one case, actually I was talking on the phone in a car, where a bank, I'm not going to say it was, wanted to acquire another bank, and I said, based on some financials and other things, I think they did about, just about died, I said, I can't support it. And I mean, the reaction was, what? The person from our own Reserve Bank isn't going to support this? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it is, because things were going well at the time. It's going against the tide, people deserve a lot of credit for.
One question finally about regulators. I'm curious, given your articulate responses to this September 4th document, were there ever any times where OFAO, later FHFA, provided you with feedback that helped improve a decision?
A specific decision, no, a specific decision, I don't think so, because they were a regulator, and see, it wasn't that we were financing mergers and things like this. I mean, this was really down in the weeds stuff when you get to credit scoring and all that stuff. I would say, though, that that they're hopping, and I use that word advisedly, on credit standards and things like that was helpful.
Okay.
I would say that they were a helpful influence during this period.
Right. And the period being 04 or later? Or?
I'd say more later. Maybe 06.
Okay. Great. Thank you. That's it. So, Bob and then Vic.
I just have a few questions. Did there come a time during your there was a time during your tenure when the private label securities blew themselves up? Do you have a view on why that, how that happened?
Well, I think, you know, look, I mean, my view on why this happened ultimately is that people didn't have skin in the game, and that if you're an originator, right, you originated the mortgages, right? You went to your packager, who might be an investment bank or someone else. They packaged them and then sold them off. But once they were sold off, right, I mean, their skin in the game, unlike Freddie and Fannie's, wasn't there, right? So I think we got into I'm talking about the country, not our two institutions, but we got into you know, almost a volume race. You know, people just wanted to get product out the door, and you get product out the door, you get paid for it, right? And you didn't have to worry about it. And I think whenever you have, you know, money's an easy thing to sell. It's getting it back.
good quote.
That's tough. And I think when people saw people making all this money, you know, they were under pressure in their own firms for doing it. One quote, if I can put it, it's in one of these books, I think it's Kindleberger's book, it says, nothing makes people so unhappy than to have left a cocktail party where everyone else is talking about how much they've made on housing and they've made nothing. You know, and people follow a herd-like instinct on this. And they get tired of their wife telling them, how come so-and-so, you know, has made so much money?
Fair enough. Historically, mortgage lending is a spread business, and it depends on quality. And I think you just suggested that maybe the business model shifted, at least for these people, to be one that depended more on volume and quantity than quality.
Well, once you switched from, it was big, big change once you switch from originate to hold to originate to securitize. Mm-hmm. Originate to hold, you're holding that thing. You got to be concerned about what happens. You're talking about originate to securitize. Well, once it's gone, it's not my problem.
Right. But Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, at the end of the chain, they were holders.
Yes, that's right.
Right. Did you recall having been brought to your attention notice the fact that there had been a gradual deterioration in underwriting standards?
I think if you just read the press at that time, that there was a gradual deterioration in underwriting standards for everything. I mean, you were reading about loans in Europe, you were reading about, I mean, look, Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, I don't know if I got them all, Great Britain, right? They didn't have Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae's. They had problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this, and that's, from a macro perspective, is going to make this so tough to get out of. But this was a problem that was occurring sort of in all asset classes everywhere. But to answer your question, yes.
And specifically in housing in the United States.
Yeah, I think in housing in the United States. But, you know, the problem was you could tell a story, or people told a story, right, that seemed fairly persuasive, because you looked at immigration, right? Yeah, you looked at new family formation, right? You looked at scrappage rate in housing. And, you know, it didn't seem crazy that demand would keep going up. Now, relating that demand going up to what was happening to pricing, I think, is something else. But that didn't get paid a lot of attention to.
You focused on the value of the collateral. How about the capacity and creditworthiness of the borrowers? Do you see deterioration there?
Yes, I think there was deterioration there. But, I mean, and we were in this market, you know, and I've thought a lot about this, as you might expect.
Go for it.
No, I mean, if you were in a lot of different businesses, right, not Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, right, you could have said, as Goldman said, or I guess as Jamie Dimon said, you know, he's going to diversify and go into other things. The problems for Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, right, is you're in this business or you're not in this business. And if you're not in this business, given our relatively precarious competitive position as before, you don't have the luxury of saying, I'm going to get out of it and come back in 3 or 4 years. You know, I mean, you're gone,
right,
at that point. And you would have had to have an awful lot of conviction that you could foresee the future and you were right to say, "Oh, I'm going to take and bet the market cap of the company and put it in the."
But Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae weren't the only two people that were buying mortgages.
No, that's right.
And have you given any thought to why other parties were in the market buying mortgages of decreasing? Where the underwriting standards were decreasing?
Chase for yield.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's going to happen again. It's been happening for 800 years. It's going to happen again. I mean, it's the old trade-off between greed and fear, and that people talk about in the markets. I mean, I can't conclude anything other than it's human nature. I mean, I come from a profession, right, that thought that we were the cat's meow for a while. You know, we could model all this stuff. We knew how people acted rationally. We could mathematically determine what they were going to do. We went 0-3. You know, we couldn't do any of it.
Well, it's interesting because you said that, what is it? It's money's an easy thing to sell. It's, the hard part is getting it back.
Yeah.
Investors must have known that. Why didn't they think of that when they went to chase the extra 50 basis points of yield?
Because other people were chasing the extra 50 points, and they felt, you know, why should I sit here and get less? I mean, you know, I mean,
everybody's doing it. It's the answer.
Everybody's doing it, and the common conviction is that these prices, at least are not going to crash. I mean, my own view on this was that what would happen to prices is that they would sort of come like this, you know, but they wouldn't turn negative. You know, I mean, they might turn negative in real terms, but in nominal terms that we could see positive price appreciation. And as long as you had positive price, right, a lot of these things would work for a while. I mean, I thought if there was air, the air would go out slowly.
Let me ask, if I may, right there, because of Freddie's financial group, that's pretty good. Housing prices peaked in mid-06. When did you know that housing prices were going to be going down? Not forget about how much.
I think in the fourth quarter of 07, late in the fourth quarter of 07, I started to become more worried about it. But that's the data for the fourth quarter of 07 now.
So that took that long for the data to percolate. I mean, now it's easy to look at the graph.
Sure.
You're saying it took that long before
I'm saying there was a lag even on 07 because I had to see the data. But right. I remember it. I think it was in the third quarter. I reckon I'm third quarter, the end of the third quarter of 07. And, you know, there's a lot of debates about the data in this, because none of the Chip Case is a friend of mine, but the Case-Shiller index, you know, isn't perfect by any means. It's got a lot of problems. So the R index, the Case-Shiller index, is done on Freddie's data. That index had some problems. And don't forget, during this whole period, to show how you can get different indices, a FAO's index was showing housing prices still rising while Case-Shiller had them going negative.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Okay. I have one more thing. Since you've left, I think you probably have seen the conservators' report. I'd be surprised if you haven't.
That one back with the top one? Thank you.
Okay.
You know, I actually haven't seen this.
You haven't seen that.
No. So the news reports on it.
Yeah.
Well, what they do is they provide it provides on page 9 a pretty good analysis of what's happened to Freddie Mac since the conservator took over. If you look in the center column, it starts out with you having $27 billion worth of capital, which I think was the audited capital at 12/31/07, and essentially says there's been losses of $90 billion, and the government's put in $63 to make it up.
Right.
It points to most of that coming from the single-family guarantee.
Right.
Is that something... Is this anything you would have? Would you have expected that this was where the losses were coming from? And they
no. I mean, it depends on when you say expected. I mean, I always thought I was foolish like a lot of other people. I guess you know, I always thought if there was risk, the risk was in the retained portfolio, where everyone else thought it was. I mean, because I thought that housing was a pretty damn stable thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the interesting thing, I think, is that actually the investments contribution is only the loss of $11 billion, which isn't a lot of money.
No, in today's...
well, actually, it would have been about half your capital. Given that you're not familiar with this, Mr. Siren, I will...
I'm sorry, I'll
leave you with that, though, because I think you'll find it interesting. I also point your attention to page 13. Which analyzes the $11 billion loss. And it started out with a $48 billion loss, which is obviously mark-to-market, mm-hmm. and something foreshadowed in your...
Where am I looking?
Freddie Mac, 2008.
Freddie Mac, 2008, okay, bottom. Yeah. Okay, 48,
this,
yeah.
This is actually an analysis of the $11 billion that's been lost since...
Oh, right? Okay.
And interestingly enough, there's a write-off of $48 billion, and then there's a write back of that of $37 billion in the following 2 years, which is the mark to market got written back up.
Yeah, right. Well, and it will get written back up on some of these things.
Hmm.
Vic, do you have questions?
I have a few. Mr. Siren.
Could I just use the head again?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I've got, what, 12?
And actually, the best way to do it so that I'm not always standing at the door.
All right, I've got 1245 roughly back on record. Mr. Siren, the former director of OFEO, Armando Falcone, testified before this commission on April 9, 2010. He began his testimony by positing a question, which I'll now pose to you. I'll read it because I'm quoting him. How do you operate a business with the most generous government subsidies possible, which confer very powerful market advantages, and run the business into the ground? I remember thinking at the time, you know, boy, if I had one of these gentlemen in the room, I'd like to push that one forward, so I have my opportunity.
Well, I think, look, as I said, housing is kind of a tabernacle in the United States. The United States is the only country in the world that I'm aware of, right? Certainly the only country of any size. We have 30-year fixed-rate mortgages, right? Prepayable without penalty. So you had a giant subsidy that went to the household sector, right? And this didn't happen overnight. I mean, it took a long time, right? And it took. And what we developed was a system where homeowners expected, right, that they could get these kinds of mortgages, and they expected that mortgages would be priced very, very tightly. Now, how you lose the money, right? That this, you could say, well, you know, if you were an insurance company, which you were, really, in a way, you know, if your premiums had been higher, that wouldn't have happened. But don't forget that at the time that all this began, I think, take the number exactly, but you know, our losses were something like half of one basis point or a tenth of a basis point or something like that, and there were complaints that the companies were being rapacious in terms of what they had. So I think what it is that you insure a whole lot of stuff, right? All right, you expect that there has to be big numbers to do this. You expect that the risk is very low, right? And you have premiums which in historical perspective turn out not to have been sufficient.
We are talking about Freddie and not AIG here. All right. Mr. Falcone supplied his own answer to that question, I quote, "Ultimately, the companies were not unwitting victims of an economic down cycle or flawed products and services of theirs. Their failure was deeply rooted in a culture of arrogance and greed. I should be clear that this was a failure of leadership. There were and are many good people in the ranks of both companies." For what it's worth, Mr. Falcone puts it on leadership. And
Where was he during
this period? Mr. Falcone screaming and waving red flags on the Orlando 7?
Mr. Falcone was interviewed.
I'd like to cross-examine Mr. Falcone on his ability of foresight and hindsight.
Your prescience, because I was about to say, since I'm sure you disagree with Mr. Falcone's reasoning, could you tell me where it's wrong?
Well, look, I mean, anyone that is trying to run any company is trying to do a whole lot of different things. We were trying to fix this company, right, at the same time that we were trying to run it. We were dealing with conflicting objectives, three conflicting objectives at least, you know. I mean, the mission side, the shareholder side, and the regulatory side. There are an awful lot of demands on the organization, and I think, you know, if this hadn't happened, right? If it had been something else, which it would have been if it wasn't housing, because of macroeconomic issues, that had blown up, you know, we'd all be looking like that we were very smart and very prescient right now. I mean, we. As an insurer, essentially, we're taking a position that housing prices in the United States wouldn't decline, and because it was because these were giant institutions, right? The numbers involved were very big.
Okay.
I'm not saying we're 100% right by a long, long shot, but hindsight is you know,
cheap.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Armando, I don't remember Armando ever coming and talking to me and saying, you know, there's going to be a big blow up. It's going to be a big blow up. You better take the thing down.
Okay. Just going with the reasoning that what goes up must come down. Did you feel, sir, if I could finish the question, that with the protracted home price appreciation and the rates of home price appreciation, that was a potentiality?
What I thought, and I thought a lot about this, what I thought would happen. See, I thought this was part of a bigger issue, which I'm not going to take the time. I think that the penultimate, the quintessential cause for these things was that the United States and several other countries have been living over their heads for at least a quarter of a century, right? We were borrowing. I mean, we lost our comparative advantage. We didn't want to lose our consumption standards, so we borrowed consumption from someplace else. China said we'd like to buy goods. We said we don't have the money. They said, we'll loan you the money, right? And all this goes into this flow overall. And we had basically balance of payments accounts and international deficit accounts that just were not reconcilable over the long run. Now, to get to your answer, my own view was that we were on a train that was going to have a problem at some point. I did not expect it was going to run into a cliff and fall off the way it did. I don't know many people that did. You know, some people did because they obviously made money on it. But I didn't know anyone that thought we were going to come like this and then go like that.
We were on a train, you mean the United States economy generally?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
At Vic's point, just to be clear and make sure you're answering this question, didn't you guys model different downturns?
Oh, we modeled all kinds of downturns, you know, and you really needed a downturn, something like this, to produce the results that we had.
And that wasn't in the historical...
No. We have more housing price models, more people working on models, and more people who had, you know, PhDs in physics and everything else that were looking at this. And they just weren't raising it. Even if you look at the people that were raising credit questions, right, they weren't raising questions. I don't recall any place in the stuff that I've read that someone said, we're headed for a giant housing price crash.
Okay. during your tenure, did Freddie get more involved in the Alt-A market?
Yes, I think he did.
Okay. What was the business purpose or what was the business case for getting more involved in Alt-A?
Oh, I think the business case for getting more involved in Alt-A, don't forget, now I'm putting my shareholder-run company hat on, right? We were losing market share during some of this period. The market, that's... If you're in the market, better or worse, if you're in the market and you're a lot of companies, you can say, I'm getting out of that market and going into something else, right? We couldn't say, I'm getting out, I'm going to something else. And that's where the market was going, and we had to take part, and we had to take part in it if we were going to be relevant.
Okay, well, taking the devil's advocate with that, if you're locked in that market, maybe if the market's going crazy, might you want to minimize risk rather than increase it, doubling down?
If you thought the market was going crazy, right? And see, that's the whole thing. But no one ahead of time, the people I'm talking about, thought that the market was going completely crazy.
Okay. But I think you said earlier that if you read the media, you understood that underwriting standards were going down.
Yes.
Okay.
That doesn't mean, by the way, that Freddie is buying something different because Freddie has a credit box.
Right.
Yeah, and let me come back to one point, right? if we had been these wastrels, right, taking greater risk than everyone else,
Why would we have the lowest default rates now? Why would we have our default rates lower than Fannie, lower than almost all private sector institutions? I mean, look, did we make a mistake? Yeah. But it's hard to say we made a mistake that was a lot bigger than other people's if we suffered from it less than other people did.
Okay. Was there internal discussion within Freddie prior to going more into the Alt-A market?
There was a lot of discussion about NINAs. Right, but and Nina's and Sissa's, but that was
for the recording. Let me say,
sorry.
No income, no asset is a Nina. Sissa, stated income, stated asset.
But that was those discussions. To be candid, were more about concerns I had about were they predatory products or not than concerns about credit loss.
There wasn't anybody who had concerns about credit loss or anything?
Oh, no. I think Andrew Conis raised issues and had concerns about credit loss. And there were, you know, we had deep discussions about this. I mean, there were people who were concerned, and then there were people who weren't concerned. There were people that thought, well, gee, you know, this may have a real effect on your ability to meet your HUD goals because of the SISAs, not because of the NINAs. And it may have effect on the entire corporation. See, part of what comes into play here is usually you do a contract with an originator for essentially most of their product, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got to be able to cover their credit box. You can't say, I'll supply you with the Pellegrino and cups, right? But I'm not doing, I'm not doing Mike's, whatever they're called. You know, if you had gotten out of the Alt-A business, right, to take an example, right, you would have lost a lot of customers, and you wouldn't have just lost their Alt-A business. You would have lost their prime business.
You could have. You could have left money on the table, lost market share.
You would have lost market share, but I think you would have lost a lot of I think if you had gone out of the Alt-A business, right, that it was a sufficiently sized and, as you point out, growing business, that I think you would have lost enough market share that over the long run, now no one knows what the long run is, that over the long run the viability of the franchise to be competitive would be a question.
That's interesting. Are you saying you bought more Alt-A because basically that was more of what the customers were selling?
To some extent, yes.
Or that Wells, for example, wouldn't send you their prime unless you took their Alt-A as well.
Well, also, but don't forget, I mean...
Example, incidentally? I heard it of a different company, but not Wells.
I thought Dick said Wells, but we've spoken so much I can't swear that.
So Wells basically said either you buy our Alt-A...
No, I don't recall that.
Any other companies did that?
No, but companies made. Did they use those exact words? But I mean, it was when you had discussions with people, they in reports would come back to me that people, you know, you were either going to be their GSE or you weren't going to be their GSE, or you know, major player is their GSE. And if you're going to be a major player in the GSE, they wanted you playing across all products. They were unhappy that we weren't doing. At least our definition of subprime.
Did Countrywide ever indicate that sentiment?
Countrywide indicated, but I'm not going to say it was to me because it was at a meeting, but Countrywide made the point that, he might have made it to me, that you need us more than we need you. And
therefore?
And therefore, you know, you better pay more attention to what we're saying. And Countrywide, for example, was very unhappy with me when I made the move to say that we wouldn't take 228s and 327s.
Now, so far, your answers to that Alt-A question. You said that you wore several hats, I think three of them, and that you had to answer to a shareholder and a regulator and whatnot. Most of that, it seems like competitive pressure, like you're answering to the shareholder getting into the Alt-A market. Is that correct? Or?
Well, the point I wanted to make that I forgot is, don't forget, you've entered into a contract under what terms you'll buy product for the next year, say, right? So then it's up to the customer to decide what they want to deliver to you, right? So you can't you can't just say, if you've delivered them a price card, right, and said I'll take this at 17.2 GP, right? You can't say, oh, I changed my mind, I want to do that. Now you can tighten up. And
the next question, though, was, were there any regulatory or mission issues associated with it?
There would have been mission issues associated with it in the following sense. If you didn't take Alt-A, right, now, Alt-A wasn't done primarily for mission purposes, but it would have had mission effects. Because if you didn't take Alt-A, it wouldn't have hurt you in the NINA area, since you had no income, so you couldn't calculate this sort of, but it would have hurt you in the CISA area. Because you had stated income to be able to calculate the ratios.
And you mean there that you could have hit your, what, affordability goals? Affordable health?
It could have affected your ability to hit your goals.
Okay. What kind of issues were, I think you said, Mr. Andrakonis?
Andrakonis.
Thank you, Andrakonis. That he was against going into this Alt-A business. What kind of arguments was he making?
If you remember.
Give me a second.
Also, if we're going to be much longer, maybe we should.
Okay. I mean, I agree with you. We all want money.
I don't want him to.
No, we're
the problem, Vic, is that there are a lot of memos that Andrakonis wrote.
There are memos
about NINA, memos about CISA. I mean, he lays out incredibly lengthy and detailed arguments.
No, I appreciate it, and I didn't mean, I apologize to put you on the spot. What I could do is maybe throw an email chain or something past you and just ask you to respond. I think I have highlighted portions and whatnot, because I think I have.
Because I remember I've seen some email chains. But to tell you the truth, I had trouble following which came first because I couldn't get the dates on them.
I apologize. I'm not as good as Tom Stanton. I'm a tree hugger, so I don't make 15 copies of everything, and I'm going to stand up anyway because of my bum knee. I'm going to bring this around, and I'm just going to ask you, it's an email chain, and why don't you start from the back, because that'll be the first one. And you'll notice there are...
The back is the first one.
Right. It stops at K.
Okay.
If you could just familiarize yourself with it, you're so good.
You want me to do that now?
Sure.
I killed another tree, but you have to find it in here.
And again, Dick, you might want to go forward to see where you pick up. Are you on this email chain eventually?
I don't know.
You'll see him towards the front.
Okay.
What's the most efficient thing for me to do?
If I were your counsel, I'd say read the whole darn thing. Read the highlighted portions at the very least. Because that's what I'll be drawing your attention to.
I will note, if you don't mind my answering things, as we seriatim, you guys say, for what senior management is focused on other things, like the restatement, which was...
Right. I noted. Is it highlighted?
Yeah,
I noted.
that it overshadowed the fact that they were losing their economic base. And what I haven't been able to figure out, and maybe if you read it you can, is are there parallels with today? Will we outrunning ourselves somehow and not noticing?
You
don't need to read this one. This is just everybody saying, yeah, we're going to discuss the CISA.
I wrote it. I'll send you a draft. Signed, Cook.
Did you write that one?
I think I did write that one.
That was a beautiful article. I thought Rosengren wrote it. But
maybe. I think I wrote it with Rosengren.
I'd love to get a copy. Because my copy is gone someplace. So I'd love to get a copy.
Okay. I'm slow. I've only skimmed it, I think I can take the question.
Okay. I was just going to ask you, first of all, if you're familiar with it. I know your name is towards the front on the CC chain. Are you familiar with the topics discussed?
Yes.
Okay. And basically, if I could characterize it, there's a discussion of what CISA loans and maybe a relaxation of underwriting standards and Freddie... buying into these loans.
Well, as I recall it, I'm not saying I recall it correctly. This was more a discussion of a binary nature. You know, were we going to stay in this product, or that's the way I thought of it. I mean, at any rate.
Okay. Or are we going to stay in it, or are we going to get out of it?
Yeah.
Okay. And what was ultimately your decision?
Well, ultimately, my decision was that we were going to, for a variety of reasons, that we were going to stay in it. The reasons had to do with shareholders.
Right.
They had to do with staying relevant in the market. They had to do with goals, and they had to do with, you know. Don't forget, I mean, we're a hurting puppy at this point, right? I mean, people had all kinds of questions of what was going to happen to Freddie, right? And that whether you could go out and...
When you say at this point, do you mean in 2004?
Yes.
In that time frame?
Yeah. Whether you could go out and get into that kind of conflict with your customers at that point, I thought was an issue.
Okay.
We weren't always afraid to do that. I mean, I hate to come back and be Johnny One Note, but don't forget, 2007 didn't call anyone. You said, we're not doing it anymore.
Right. Right.
And I would also say that I think probably, to be candid in my own thought process, these memos are April of 2004, I've come in January, you know, and this is a pretty big change. And, you know, I don't know if I'm feeling brave enough to...
Okay. To I appreciate your candor. And again... you say that it says in there that upper management was looking at basically the accounting restatement at the time.
The amount of time I was spending on the accounting restatement, I mean, and trying to get people for accounting, and because we didn't have what rank they would have as compared to people complaining in the rest of the organization, because we didn't have a functional HR department. People coming to me and saying, you know, you got to make this guy a second vice president, and someone else saying, well, that's my problem, not yours.
Okay. So Andrew Conis weighed in pretty heavily in there against, I believe, Don Basinius.
Andrew Conis, don't forget, wasn't responsible for mission. I was responsible for meeting
correct.
The mission.
Correct. Don Basinius, I thought, had an interesting twist in there, saying, hey, we got burned on this stuff before. Do we think we're any smarter?
Yeah, but then there was a response, I can't find it right here now, from May on...
maybe a different email chain you're thinking of.
No, I saw it in this email chain talking about things that had changed, and we had... here it is.
The FICO.
Yeah. I don't believe we will take inordinate losses and generate significant fraud cases given the difference between now and then. The three key differences, as I understand them, is one, we are using FICO scores. I don't believe we used them before. Two, we are requiring the IRS form 4506. I tried to remember that. I couldn't remember the form number.
Good luck.
Yeah. This process and form didn't exist back then. And three, we are requiring loan prospector. This didn't exist back then. So
right.
You're saying that there was...
Now, didn't Andrew Conis weigh in about those, address those issues, though, about drive-by appraisals and whatnot as well?
I remember the phrase drive-by appraisal, okay. So I'll take your word for it that he raised
okay,
it.
If I could get that. Yeah,
sure.
I know we're running late, and I had another string I was going to pass you, but we are certainly want to be sensitive to your time. Mr. Andrew Conis left.
Yes.
Left Freddie. What were the circumstances under which he left?
He was asked to leave.
By whom?
Myself and Gene McQuaid, who was the chief operating officer.
Okay. Was there a basis, a reason for your asking him?
Say there were a couple of reasons. One, very important is, and I discussed this with the chairman of the committee that he reported to. You know, all our committees, board committees, had staff that reported to them independently, not through the through the management. At this time, this was a big deal. How capable was he in assessing the risks in the retained portfolio? Was one issue, and the other issue is I thought that anyone that was a senior officer of the corporation, and he was a senior officer of the corporation, he was a good guy. You've got to look at, you've got to be sure that you do your job and provide the advice that goes with your specific area, but you also have to take into consideration and come forward with ideas about how do you deal with the overall goals and needs of the corporations. Basically, right, I just was not satisfied with what we were doing on mission, right? And I thought that the way that we had handled meeting mission goals in the past, I was a little unsavory in some cases. I didn't like it. I told people that when I took the job, and if you look, I don't want to get into it, but if you look at the stuff I've written through my life, right, go back to the Boston Fed stuff, you look at stuff as early as 1968, I've always been someone who was big into this housing mission thing. Now, maybe I'm crazy, right? But I really believed in it, right? And I believed there wasn't a reason to have these institutions really and have them as powerful as they were if they weren't going to do it and if they weren't going to believe in it. And that was how it fit together.
So
if I could characterize, because I'm not sure 100% that I got it, mission, you mean affordable housing goal?
Yes.
And was Mr. Andrikonis intransigent on accommodating?
No, but he was not helpful on how we could we're gonna have to pass intransigent now.
Was he digging in his heels as far as reducing or relaxing underwriting in order to fit, you know, whatever the goals were at that point, 50% to 55%?
Well, I didn't think he was as sympathetic to what we had to do to meet our goals as was necessary, and I had a legitimate difference of opinion on how dangerous it was. Right now, as it turns out, he should have gone short. I mean, he could have made a fortune. I mean, he was able to foresee the market better than a lot of the rest of us could.
Well, he's a risk guy. I would think that a risk guy sees risks.
Yeah.
But that was the major contention, was his inability to meet you halfway on a affordable housing goal.
Well, to meet, you know, and to see what we could do on affordable housing goals. I mean, there wasn't any reason, as a creature of the Congress, for this organization to exist, at least the way it was structured, right? Unless it was going to have these, you can't say you're going to do it and not do it.
You should just, for what it's worth, Vic, you should be careful. He uses the word mission.
Right.
He doesn't necessarily equate that to affordable housing goals, because
it's mission
to provide liquidity and da 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 da. So I just don't want his inartful answers to mislead you.
No. I was making that assumption, and that's what I was trying to draw. I was wondering. That's the way I was reading it. So right. I just wanted to be sure.
Of course, liquidity became less important after securitization was invented.
That's right. So. Well, a lot less important.
All right. I don't think I have. If we have anything additional, would we be able to submit something in writing?
Or we can get on the phone, frankly.
Okay. Thanks an awful lot.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate your help.
Very helpful. And if we could get a copy.